Herzlich willkommen zu Mein Element, dem Podcast vom Lützeburger Journal und zusammen arbeite ich mit dem FNR, dem Luxembourg National Research Fund.
I think that when people think about history, they don't think about technology. We have this romantic idea of spending time in the archives and doing that. But what I know, because I do historical research in the archives, is that that hasn't been the case. Well, maybe it was never the case. And so this was a very scarring, traumatic moment in my early life. I was late finishing high school, starting university, when all of these losses were happening. And so this really made a big impact on me.
Der Sommer ist rüber und es ist Zeit für ein neues Episode von Mein Element. Mein Name wird dir von heute Austin Sean Taggart. An den du den ultra spannenden Job. An vielleicht von dir heraus, wen dass der das? Ich habe Sean nämlich gefragt, wie ihn dann sein Erbeschrift beschreiben, an dem sie just drei Emojis benutzen darf.
With three emojis? Yikes. I think the emojis I use most often are probably deeply offensive and so inappropriate for describing my job. Wow. You've really stumped me. I would say, of course, there's the sort of like thinking emoji, you know, the hand on the chin, kind of like looking up with the monocle. That's one, you know, thinking about the work that we do. I often use the rocket ship emoji, blasting off, because it's like, let's go, let's go, let's go. And then sometimes I like to use the robot emoji also, that's sort of like beep, beep, boop, boop thinking, like, you know, that sort of more artificial thinking, putting on that hat and thinking more like a computer. So I think those are the ones I would use most, but I don't know, that's a very strange question. I like it.
Für die, die du nicht so draus von tun, du schaust als Historiker. Du schaffst also durch die Vergangenheit für uns verständlich zu machen und abzuschaffen. Der klingt zwar nur am echten Moment nicht nur Rocket Ship und Roboter-Emoji, und trotzdem hat das perfekt gepasst. Weil der Sean schafft aktiv darunter den Beruf von den Historiker an das 21. Jahrhundert zu heben. Vorher schüsst, wie verbinden das Vergangenheit und Technologie?
So, I mean, I can tell you two stories about that. One which makes sense, but is a lie. And then the other which doesn't make sense and is the truth.
We are big fans of the truth, but please tell the lie.
Okay. So I'll tell you the lie first, which is, it makes perfect sense, which is that as a student, as an undergraduate, I was a history major and also an economics major, but I became a history major later, focused on history, really loved it. When I finished my undergraduate studies, I wanted to go to graduate school for history. But before that, I also wanted to make some money. And so I took a job at IBM for several years in the 1990s. And then when I went back to get my PhD, I had this technology background. And so in those days, I was one of the only PhD students I knew in humanities and the history who had a technology background. So I was able to use some of those skills in my own thesis, by a PhD thesis research. And then when it was time to look for a job, when I was done with my PhD, I found a job at the place called the Center for History and New Media, just outside Washington, D.C., which did exactly this kind of work of kind of mashing up technology and history together. So you can see my whole career was perfectly lined up for this eventuality where I would merge history
for
and technology.
For this podcast interview.
For this podcast even. It all led to this moment.
You worked very long to come here.
Exactly. I've been waiting for you. So, but that's the sort of lie in hindsight where we can kind of make a nice story that lines up with things that happened in the past where the chronology makes sense. But the reality is a bit more complicated. I mean, the reality of why I took a job in Washington, D.C. is that's was where my wife was working. And so I needed to be close to where she was going to be, where our child was going to be. So I wanted to be there. And this was the only really good job for me to take in Washington, D.C. at that moment. So really, it was taking that job really that put me on this path to, okay, I now have a job that is it combines these two things. I now need to really focus on this and what can I do in this field? So it was really more of a right place at the right time than a plan to end up there.
Dann würde mich froh, also sich leben. Viele Umstände haben sich zusammengefunden, sodass der Sean heute zu Lützburg lebt und unter anderem am Bereich Digital History innoviert. Me, was ist eigentlich Digital History? Aus der Geschichte vom Fax bis bei dem Smartphone oder etwas komplett anderes? Könntest du vielleicht eine Definition?
Sure, that's a question that not only do you ask us, do outsiders ask us what digital history is, but it's something we ask ourselves here all the time. What is digital history? How do you define that? And it's a pretty wide, there are a wide range of answers to what digital history is. It can mean the kinds of things that we do in our team here, which is really to create tools to help us do historical research. We focus mostly on research in my team, but it can also mean using digital technology to tell history, right, to present history in a new way. It can mean using digital technology to disseminate, to share history in new ways, so different modes of publication, different modes of circulating historical knowledge. It can involve new ways of creating history in terms of public engagement, so inviting the public to participate in the creation of new historical narratives. So there's a lot of things that digital history can be. But I see your kind of bigger point, which is I think that when people think about history, they don't think about technology. And so maybe I have a question for you. What do you think, when you think of a historian, I'm not going to ask you what emojis you think of, but what do you think a historian does?
For me, a historian was, at the beginning when I was very, when I was a child, I thought it was like Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. I think it's, for me, someone who tries to understand why things happened in the past and what we can learn from them later in the future, was my definition of it. I know it's not that right, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a perfect definition. But what I was asking and what I'm curious about is how you think a historian does that, and how do you think that knowledge
always
is created?
Archives.
Right.
Okay. Always digging deep in old paper that you can't touch, or if you breathe falsely on it, it will disappear into dust.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Exactly. So this is, I think this is a very common, very romantic understanding of what a historian does, that maybe we sit in big, comfortable leather armchairs and we have a desk lamp shining over our papers and we are studying them carefully and very carefully turning them. Maybe we're wearing special gloves to protect the paper, which you actually should not do. The good archives always say it's better to touch the paper with your hand because you don't risk damaging it. So we have this romantic idea of spending time in the archives and doing that. But what I know, because I do historical research in the archives, is that that hasn't been the case. Well, maybe it was never the case, but it certainly has not been the case for the last 20 years, where when a historian goes to the archives today, or really anybody goes to the archives today, they are not sitting there reading, they're photographing. They're often not sitting there standing over a box of documents that they are passing under their cell phone and photographing page after page after page. Mm-hmm. And then maybe later they do something with these images, maybe not. So the actual practice of a historian has changed with this digital technology of taking photos. And then the question of what you do with those photos, this is another whole digital question, and it's the focus of what a lot of my team does.
Die merkt Digital History aus dem Bredfeld. So breit, dass der Sean mittlerweile sogar in der grüner Gang aus. Hier schafft man seine Equipe und Zotero Anthropy. Und das klingt im nächsten Moment nur griechische mythologische Figuren oder nur Pokémon, mehr Wirklichkeit sind das zwei Programme, mit denen ihn dabei von Historikerinnen und Historiker an die digitale Welt kann hirven. Die zwei Programme helfen, dabei an Archive und die digitale Arbeitsweise von heute anzupassen. Tropy zum Beispiel vereinfacht Schaffen an Archive so, dass ihn am Schluss von einem Archivtag nicht mehr 1000 Fotos hört man nun img257.jpg, mehr dass das Fotos ganz einfach benannt gehen, gespeichert gehen und auch schon sortiert können gehen. Der Schaum hilft derbest also an das neue Millennium, wie diese Woche wird Demos war, wie noch stundenlang selber führende Bücher an der Papierresorts an die durchgelesen wird. Seit für Seit für Seit. Und wie das in die Zoom-Methode kennt, wollte ich von ihm wissen, möchte derbest am Archiv der Lohr eigentlich mehr Spaß oder wäre es früher besser?
The first time I visited the archives was in 1999, so 25 years ago. Oh, sorry, 1995 or 96. I'm 29 years ago, so a long time ago. So, I mean, laptops existed, you know, we had computers, but the practice, no one was taking digital photographs in archives. So it was this more, you know, traditional method of research. I do like working in the archives. I mean, there's for all kinds of reasons, there is a sort of serendipity of working in the archives where, you know, you don't, when you go to an archive, it's very rare that you request a specific document because archives are not organized like a library where each book has a call number. Instead, archives are organized according to how the documents entered the archives. So sometimes it's, you know, they're just by a box or a folder. Archives measure their collections in linear kilometers of shelf space. So, you know, and what is a meter of shelf space? Is it a bunch of papers lined up? Is it a box of things? It's a kind of a mystery sometimes until the box comes to your desk and you're waiting for it and you open the box and you look inside. And maybe the document you are looking for is inside, but maybe not. And also while you're looking for that document, maybe you find something else. And this is very different from, say, the kind of searching that you or I are accustomed to today, or my students are accustomed to, where they Google something and they search and they know exactly what they're looking for and they find it. And you don't find what you're not looking for, which sounds obvious, but it's really clear when you're doing something like keyword search versus opening a box and seeing what's inside. So that can be enjoyable, but I won't want to romanticize it. It's very frustrating and very slow to work in archives, which is, this is not to blame archivists or to blame the archives. This is just the reality of it, that it's a slow, patient process, which can be rewarding. It forces you to slow down and take your time, forces you to read sometimes, which is good as opposed to just photographing. Another plus is you meet people. So I'm American, as you know, and as everyone could hear from my voice, but as that means that if someone who is interested in French history, my research focus was always on early modern France, which is like France between, say, 1500 and the French Revolution, 1500, 1800. For that kind of research coming from the United States, we have some sources in the United States that were on microfilm or something like that. But to do research, you had to go to France to do this kind of research, or you got to go to France to do this kind of research. And this is exciting. You know, you get to be in France and you get to, you know, do research, but also you get to meet other people who are generally there in the summertime, right? That's when when it's in between the academic semesters. And so you end up meeting other people who are, you know, maybe other graduate students when you're a student, or maybe they're more senior people when you're an early career researcher, and they're maybe working on something related to what you are doing, and you meet people from other universities. It's great. That can be really fun.
There was one question I wanted to ask you. How hard is it to do your research about a subject from a different country on another continent from the 1500 when you were living in the States? So how do you do that? You partly answered already.
Yeah.
So the other question was why? Why this subject? Because honestly, it's a little bit odd if you think about it, that a person from America wants to know more about French medicine, for example, in the 1500.
Well, I mean, it's all odd. I mean, I think if you look at every book on the shelf or every historical topic, I mean, they're mostly quite odd. For me, it's not odd at all.
Yeah, I mean, course,
there is somehow
you got interest in that subject.
So again, there's this sort of the neat and clean story, and then the reality. For me, I mean, as you know, Americans in general are not like Luxembourgers. I mean, the idea of the multilingualism in Luxembourg is almost incomprehensible to Americans. Now, I don't say that Americans are all, you know, monolingual, only speak one language. That's not true. Lots of Americans are bilingual, especially speaking, say, Spanish and English, but also America, as you know, is full of first and second generation Americans from other countries. So there is plenty of multilingualism in America, but it's not like Luxembourg, where really it is I think, a core part of Luxembourgish identity. And certainly teaching here at this university, it's absolutely fantastic to have students who can do primary source, can do original research in multiple languages. In the United States, I rarely had students who could do research in multiple languages like I have here. But in my case, how I got interested in this, I had the opportunity when I was young to learn French at school, which was unusual. Most Americans did not have at that age, at that time, the opportunity to study foreign languages. And I have a family also, my mother's family, was originally Francophone. My grandmother was speaking primarily French until she was 18 years old in the United States. She was from Maine in the Northeast. So we have a family connection to the French language. So this gave me the ability to do some research in another language other than English. And so that was exciting to me. It was exciting to go to someplace else to do research. So it wasn't that doing the research in France was hard and an obstacle. Actually, was an attraction to go do research someplace in another language. And I'm sure if I had grown up, you know, knowing Chinese or German or something like that, that I would have focused on those kinds of research areas instead. So it was not a barrier. It was actually something that attracted me to do research in France.
Für ein Interview hat also Sean aus seinem Büro empfangen. Und du, gehört eine Sache, die mir direkt an den Darm gestochen ist. Und zwar ein Stuhl. Oh nee, kein Sorge, der Tag hat noch kein Mivel-Podcast, könnt noch hier Gutscheincode. Aber der Stuhl, keine Ahnung, den hat mich irgendwie gecatcht. Weil war edel, aber auch schlicht, war prominent platziert, aber auch nicht abdränglich. Und ja, den hat so ein ganz komisch Aura. Und ich bin wirklich gedacht, was ist das an dem Stuhl dafür? Was catcht der mich die ganze Zeit? Und dann habe ich irgendwann gemerkt, der Stuhl, den hat ein Plakat. Und der Plakat steht ganz groß Yale University. Die Uni, ob der denn Sean war, und nicht nur, ob der Yale University waren, wenn hast du nur noch Michigan gewesselt, also eine andere weltbekannte Uni. Und ich fand vielleicht ab, dass er da Luffy die erste Kehr, obwohl denn Sean eigentlich schon für seinen Parkour geschwart hat. Das heißt, Grund genug für mich, du einen Knut zu haken, und noch viel zu freuen, war das dann ein Unterschied zwischen dem Teaching, ob diesen weltbekannten Unien, und seinem Teaching, den Hello, ob der Uni erlauben möchte.
So at Yale, I didn't do any teaching. So my experience, I was an undergraduate there. So my experience there is limited to being a student. So I can kind of compare a little bit how I felt as a student there to how I might imagine students are here. But I had a lot of experience, a good amount of experience teaching at the University of Michigan, because as part of my PhD studies there, I was also a teaching assistant, which meant you were teaching discussion sections of courses. And I did that for, I believe, 5 semesters. So I taught 5 different courses while I was there as a teaching assistant. And then I would add to that a comparison as well, the university where I taught in the United States before coming here, which was George Mason University in the Washington, D.C. area. And that's a large public university. It's the largest public university in the Virginia state system, which at that time had about a little over 30,000 students. I'm not sure how big it is today. So that's kind of 3 different environments of students. And I would say my students here they're more like the University of Michigan students than probably the George Mason students. And that's because at George Mason, I had a lot of what we call non-traditional students, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term, but that means students who are not basically in their 20s, right? So you would often have students at George Mason who were, sometimes they were retired and they were getting an education late in life. Sometimes they had a working career already and they were juggling a job and family and these kinds of things. And this made for a very interesting teaching environment because you had these mixed classrooms where you had really like very different perspectives on teaching. And so, for example, if you were teaching a course on early modern European history, and, you know, I'm not a military historian, but of course, as we all know, there's plenty of war in the past, not just the present. And so we would be talking about military history, and you would have students who had, you know, not only had some military experience, but maybe had a career in the military. So this was really a very different teaching environment. Where here the students tend to be, my students anyways, have tended to be more in that sort of traditional band of students who are younger and not quite so diverse in terms of life experience.
Coming back one time to Yale, because I just wanted to ask, do you also get that pipe?
Yes, the little clay pipe that we receive on graduation that we then smash. Yes, yes. And I smash it. I don't have it anymore. I did see that some of my classmates at graduation, so to explain this tradition, when you graduate from Yale, everybody is issued this very small ceramic, sort of clay, ceremonial pipe. And you're meant to destroy it when you graduate to show that you are, not that you are anti-tobacco, but you're giving up these childish ways. At least that's my memory. I graduated from Yale 28 years ago. So I may not have it fresh in my mind, but you are meant to give this up, and show that you are now mature and crush it. And I did do that. But I did see that some of my classmates kept the pipe as a souvenir. And I sometimes wish maybe I had kept it, you know, so that I would still have it. But then I think, you know, then I would not have given up my childish ways and would not have gotten to where I am today if I had still been smoking that pipe. So it's probably good that I did crush it.
So people really did smoke out of the pipe?
No, they give it to you right when you graduate.
Ah, okay. I think you get it at the beginning and then people smoke out of it.
No, they give it to you right at the end. Because okay. If they gave it to the beginning, everybody would break it or smoke out of it and lose it. So no, they maybe they used to give it to you at the beginning. I think they gave it to us literally the day we were graduating at that moment.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I also looked up a little bit of Michigan. Not only you, but also other famous people went there. Do you know which ones?
Do I know which ones went to the University of Michigan?
The most famous ones.
Well, the most famous one is probably Gerald Ford, President of the United States.
Yeah. And then I also had Darth Vader, so James Earl Jones.
Okay.
Madonna. Larry Page. And Tom Brady. And Tom Brady, that's where I wanted to make the bridge, also is a person that is very famous in your favorite sport.
Well, Tom Brady is a challenging one for me because he was quarterback of the University of Michigan football team just as I was starting my studies there. So the university had a very successful team. He was exiting to go play professional American football. But then he became the quarterback of a team which is not my hometown's team. So my hometown in the United States is Buffalo, New York, which has its for its football team, the Buffalo Bills, which are most famous. I mean, they are the most famous team in American football for one fact, which is that they have spectacularly lost the national championship. Not just once, not twice, not three times, but four times in a row. They went to the national championship and lost the game. So this is the game that everybody in the country was watching, and they lost. So they are famous for being losers. Mm-hmm. and so this was a very scarring, traumatic moment in my early life. I was late finishing high school, starting university when all of these losses were happening. And so this really made a big impact on me. So thank you for, reminding me of this trauma.
This trauma therapy.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and I should hasten to add, Tom Brady then was the architect of, he was not playing for any of the rivals of the Bills then, but then he was the architect of so many Super Bowl victories, often at the expense of Buffalo because they are in the same division and he was just winning constantly against them and everyone else, but yes.
How hard is it to follow your favorite sports or other things that you loved in America when you're here in Luxembourg?
It's not so hard. I mean, there are ways to get. I mean, the main thing is time difference. Sports, I mean, the one thing you want to watch live. Nobody wants to watch you have to be a bit deranged to want to watch a recording of a sporting event. So, you know, you are watching things at least, you know, it's 6 hours later. So if it's an afternoon game, you have to stay up very late. If it's an evening game, you have to stay up all night long. There are ways around these things. We all know, you know, technology ways. I'm not going to get into that and get myself into any trouble. But yes, there are ways to watch these things. And increasingly, American football has been making a huge push into Europe, where there are teams which now American teams will play games in, say, in Frankfurt, in Munich, in London. And I have a good friend who's a a sports reporter who was talking, explaining this to me about how this is the big push for the National Football League in the United States is to basically get into the European market to grow its viewers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's coming.
It's coming. Kommen wir zurück bei Digital History oder besser gesagt bei Geschichtsforschung an der digitalen Zeit. Ich meine, wir können alle gut schreiben, dass künstliche Intelligenz bzw. die für uns zugängliche KI ein absoluter Gamechanger ist. Und so auch wahrscheinlich an der Geschichtsforschung. Aber was geschichtliche Forschung eigentlich so spannend macht, ist immer der Kontext. Ein Dokument aus dem Jahr 1930 liest sich anders wie ein Dokument aus dem Jahr 1970. Sogar wann die zwei dynamische Thema behalten, den Zeitgeist bei einer anderen. Diese Interpretation kann ein KI halt noch nicht hin. Aber wie sind die Chancen als ein Digital History Unit eigentlich den Ersatz von künstlicher Intelligenz an der Forschung?
So this is something that has absolutely transformed historical research. Well, I think it's already transformed historical research. My colleagues may disagree and think it's only going to transform historical research. But it's changed so rapidly that even in the short time that I've been in Luxembourg, my research project, if we were to reconceive it today, my research focus, we would be focusing almost entirely on this question of artificial intelligence and how to use it better, but also to understand it. My belief is that we need to use it in order to understand it better. Many of my colleagues are eager to criticize it out of hand, and their criticisms, I agree with their criticisms, but I also think they're not necessarily supported by using artificial intelligence. There are different kinds of artificial intelligence. I think what you're describing is mostly in the sort of vein of things like ChatGPT, produced by OpenAI, or Claude, which is produced by Anthropic, Mistral, the French competitors. France always has to have its own things. Those are large language models. That's a particular form of artificial intelligence. The question about context and document contextualization, this has transformed radically even in the last few months. I mean, it's hard to remember even that ChatGPT has only been on the radar for most people for about a year and a half, only since late 2022. So we're not even 2 years into ChatGPT really being like something that everybody knows about, let alone is using. If we were to look at the earlier versions of ChatGPT, like from a few months ago, version 3.5, for example, you could upload just as I was describing earlier, a photograph of a document from the 18th century, which is handwritten text. And it's hard to describe that in a podcast, but we know that young people today, perhaps you have difficulty reading cursive handwriting, right? The old handwriting of the past. And so this is something that's very difficult for many people to understand. There's a whole science to this called paleography, how you can read the writing of the past. And it's something that historians and researchers would train themselves how to read this. It's intuitive and easy for me to read this handwriting now just from practice. This was an insurmountable technological problem 10 years ago. But today there are lots of models. Transcribus is a consortium here in Europe which can do handwritten text recognition, HTR. You've heard of OCR, optical character recognition, but this is the handwriting version of that. It's now excellent. And ChatGPT can do the same now. So you could feed this document that I was describing a few months ago into version 3.5, and it would do an okay job of the text recognition. But then if you asked the ChatGPT to tell me, well, what is the document about? What's the context for it? It gave an okay, not too bad understanding. And then if we look at the more recent versions, it's getting much better and a much better understanding of just the general gist of a document. So we can feed it a document and it can say, it might make some mistakes about the every detail of the text, but it will say, this is a document about medicine in the 18th century Caribbean and the health challenges that French soldiers were facing in the tropics. That's very good.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's telling you that, it's telling me that in English for a document that is in French. And if you were communicating with ChatGPT in Spanish, it would be telling you this in Spanish. And I should hasten to add, I am not here to give you an advertisement or do publicity for ChatGPT and OpenAI. I am actually a strong proponent of Anthropic, which is what we are increasingly moving to here on our team. And their Claude product, but that's another story for maybe another podcast.
Die wisst es. An diesem Podcast probieren wir immer ein bisschen Leute außerhalb von ihrem Beruf kennenzulernen. Dafür wollte ich dann noch vom Sean wissen, in welchem Bereich das hin außerhalb von seiner Forschung in enzyklopädisch Wissen hat. Meistens hört ihr immer diesen so ein nischisch Wissen, was kein Mensch interessiert, wie ihr selber als ein absoluter Experte dran. Ich gebe euch ein Beispiel. Mich könnte zum Beispiel alles über Dragon Ball Z freuen. Ich bin mir ziemlich sicher, dass ich euch die richtige Antwort gebe. Was manchmal mit dem Wissen wahrscheinlich niemals irgendetwas. Aber das Wissen ist aber du. Und dafür freue ich mich, geht es da doch beim Schauen. Wo sehen ihr richtigen Nerd dran?
Yes, and not only do I have this, I am always impressed about the encyclopedic knowledge that my colleagues have. I know a historian who is an expert at creating guitars from scratch, carving the wood, making the guitars, beautiful, playable guitars. Another historian also in woodworking who makes his own furniture. So I'm giving you these examples first to show that my examples are really lame and not so impressive by comparison. I want you to put me in the context of my peers who are really have amazing encyclopedic knowledge and mine, which is maybe embarrassing. So I would say, of the kinds of things that I do a lot of things with my hands. I'm very interested in sort of fixing, even though I work in technology, I love to do things around the house. Like last weekend, my wife and I were installing a new kitchen ourselves. So assembling the cabinets, doing the electrical work, doing the plumbing, these kinds of things. I like doing that, but I would say that the kind of unusual thing that I think you probably want to hear is I have a pretty encyclopedic knowledge of Vespa repair.
Okay.
So because I have a 1969 Vespa Sprint 150, which I bought for my wife as a gift. She rode it once, and that was the end of that. It became mine. I had it initially restored for her as a gift, but the restoration was, let's say, not perfect. And even if it had been perfect, we've had it for 14 years now. This Vespa, it requires constant maintenance. It's always, always in need of a new part, a new repair, and nothing ever works exactly right. So even if you can find a perfect part for it, it doesn't fit. You have to, you know, use tools to grind the metal down to make it fit just right. It's always never quite right. And so I think this is good philosophically because you have to learn to live with something that will never be perfect. and also is not even original anymore. You know, these people who say, oh, it's an original thing. No, it's not. It's the ship of Theseus. Every part has been replaced over time. So yes, this is my baby. I love my ugly 1960s mustard yellow Vespa that, you know, in theory, we'll go 100 kilometers an hour, but let's face it, is lucky to break 60. That is probably my encyclopedic knowledge of something. I can tell you all about how the brakes work and how to replace the gears and the speedometer and so on. And you have to have this knowledge because you can't ask anyone else. That's the thing. If you don't learn it, there's no one to turn to. You can't turn to the internet. You can turn to books, but really you have to learn it yourself because it,
okay. Has it a name?
The Vespa?
Yeah.
No, there's no name for the Vespa.
Why?
I don't know.
Because I thought if you're so emotionally invested into it and spend so much time with it to repair and...
Well, I certainly have called it names, but they're usually offensive words that are probably not appropriate for your podcast. So yes, I have called it things. It has names, but they're not ones that I think are polite to share.
And what is one question that you wanted to be asked but never got asked before?
Well, I think you asked me about my Vespa. That's that would be one of them. A question I've wanted to be asked but never been asked before. I think that constitutionally, I don't have that feeling. I think I'm always nervous about questions more than been wanting questions to be asked. I'm worried that I won't know the answer to the question. So I don't think I have a question that I hope you would ask me about. But I loved being asked. I mean, I liked being asked about the Vespa. I like being asked about, I think I like being asked about things that are outside of my work.
Okay.
I think that's in general what I like to be asked about.
Sean, thank you very much. The last words are always for the guest. Thank you for the interview.
Oh, and thank you, Max. I really enjoyed speaking to you today. I enjoyed your questions and you really stumped me a couple of times and I like that.
Emojis, digital history, the Tom Brady an den Mustard gilt Motorrad. Das Episode von Mein Element hat verschiedene Sujets. Und ich fand, das möchte die Gespräche heuer immer aus, dass sie einzigartig gehen und in alle Richtungen können gehen. Wie immer so ein Job dieser Platz, dem Lützeburger Journal und dem FNR, dem Luxemburg Research Fund. Merci für das Mädchen von diesem Projekt. Und wenn euch dieser Podcast gefallen hat, dann muss ich noch ganz zwei Sachen machen. Einkehr, jeder Rangem, den ihr kennt, diesen Podcast weisen. Und, falls ihr nicht gemacht habt, einkehr durch den Feed scrollen und vielleicht von euch noch eine Episode, die ich ausschwärzt. Und dann gebe ich so ein Herum aus die nächste Kehr. Bis dann. Ciao.